Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, January 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. Starting on today's front page, our first headline reads, Fully Funding Preschool Teacher Pay Priorities for Iowa Schools. School Leaders Seek 5% Boost in State Supplemental Aid by Grace King. Iowa educators are asking state lawmakers this year to fully fund preschool for four-year-olds, saying it's an essential component in closing learning achievement gaps and getting parents back to work. School leaders also are asking for a 5% increase to state supplemental aid, well over recent increases to the per pupil funding stream, as schools struggle to keep up with inflation and attract and retain staff. Iowa's statewide voluntary preschool program now provides funding to offer free half-day preschool to four-year-olds. But half-day programs can be a barrier for working families who are unable to find childcare before or after, or transportation for their kids. One large district in the state, the Cedar Rapids Community School District, last year opened its first full-day preschool program with the help of short-term pandemic relief funding, which is set to expire this September. After 2 years of the program at the Truman Early Learning Center being funded by federal dollars, the American Rescue Plan Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief, the district will have to resort to state funding that now funds preschool at half the usual per pupil rate. Last February, Carla Hogan, Cedar Rapids School's Executive Director of Business Services, said the district is banking or saving state funds it is receiving for preschool to continue budgeting for full-day programming for the 2024-25 school year. Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican of New Hartford, said while fully funding four-year-old preschool could be a conversation for lawmakers this upcoming legislative session, he said he doesn't want to commit to anything until priorities are set by the governor. Similarly, Iowa State Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican of Grimes, Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican of Grimes, said he also was waiting to hear what Governor Kim Reynolds would propose. Reynolds, who will lay out her legislative agenda in a January 9th condition of the state address, declined to be interviewed for this series of legislative previews. The state spends about 43% of its general fund budget on K-12 education, according to the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency. For fiscal 2024, the current budget year, lawmakers approved about $3.7 billion for public K-12 education, out of an overall state budget of about $8.5 billion. Publicly, fully funding for four-year-old preschool is a great idea that Democratic lawmakers have been pushing for a long time, said House Minority Leader Jennifer Confirst, Democrat of Windsor Heights. We know that reading and math scores are better when kids go to preschool, she said. Let's make it more available to all Iowa kids. I have some hope that could happen this year. I'm hearing a more diverse coalition is coming forward to speak to the importance of preschool. Confirst said it's important the Iowa legislature refocuses our energies on public education this year. About 500,000 kids go to public schools in the state, she said. A much smaller number go to private schools, and yet all of the education policy has been about funding and the attention Republicans have placed on private schools. In May, Reynolds said she hopes to address Iowa public school teacher salaries during this legislative session, which begins Monday. Reynolds said she has been told by rural school administrators that the issue of teacher salaries is especially critical in their districts as they struggle to attract and retain workers. They weren't able to pay, a lot of times, as much as some of the more urban school districts were able to pay, Reynolds said during a May appearance on Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. Whitfer said teacher pay and funding for four-year-old preschool are issues of interest to Republicans in the Senate. But with much of the debate over the last 2 years being focused on using state funding to pay for private school tuition, I don't know exactly where either one of them goes yet in this session. But we know, and I know, that 90% of our kids and probably 95% of our education money is going to continue to go to public schools, and we need to make sure that kids all over the state are getting the services they need and the education they need, he said. And so teacher salaries is part of that conversation, and we look forward to having that conversation. Iowa's average full-time teacher salary in the 2022-23 school year was just above $63,000, according to State Education Department data. In the 2021-22 school year, the average was $59,581, which put Iowa 27th in the nation in teacher pay, according to the National Education Association. We've known for a long time that teachers need to be paid better, Confirst said. We want to make sure what Reynolds announces is actually something that's going to help. Are we only going to raise teacher pay for incoming teachers, which is great, But what about the teachers who've been there 20 years? State supplemental aid, which is based on the number of students attending a school district, runs a year behind. Student counts from November 2023 will be used to determine funding for the fiscal 2025 budget. This funding stream is crucial for districts to manage operating costs, reduce class sizes, retain high-quality staff, and make up for decades of underfunding, educators say. Cedar Rapids School Board President Cindy Garlock said the 3% increase in state aid schools received last year is not enough to keep up with inflation. The cost of operating a school district increases by about 3% to 4% each year, according to School Administrators of Iowa. However, over the last 10 years, state aid has increased at a rate of less than 2.1% a year on average. Iowa lawmakers must set the growth rate for state supplemental aid in the first 30 days of each session. From March 2021 to March 2022, inflation reached 8.5% in Iowa. Many school boards in the state are asking for an increase of at least 5%. Attracting staff to Iowa and our school districts is at a critical place, Garlock said at a school board meeting last month where lawmakers were present. Without competitive salaries, that is going to continue to be a problem. State supplemental aid affects everything from staffing to the programs we can offer. The Cedar Rapids School Board also is asking lawmakers to give additional funding through state supplemental aid for students experiencing poverty. The roughly 16,000 student Cedar Rapids district filled 148 teaching positions ahead of the 2023-24 school year, but some positions were left unfilled. Cedar Rapids School Board member Nancy Humble said in a board meeting last month. She attributed this partially to the wage gap between educators and other professionals. Further stretching the budget is declining enrollment experienced by many districts, with districts such as Cedar Rapids planning millions in cost reductions from the general fund that pays staff salaries and benefits. To begin accomplishing this, school leaders are asking for more flexibility and using a management fund to offer retention incentives, pay competitive wages, and provide resources to school districts for ongoing professional development training. The management fund now can be used to pay the costs of unemployment, early retirement benefits, liability insurance, judgments or settlements related to liability, and mediation and arbitration costs. This fund cannot be used for employee health, life, or disability insurance. College Community School District Superintendent Doug Wheeler said schools are facing a balancing act because of inflation between paying employees and keeping the lights on. Schools also are spending more money than ever before on safety and security, cybersecurity, and mental health, Wheeler said. We need a clear line of funding for those things. Teacher pay slipping is a symptom of an overall problem of inadequately funding schools, said Wheeler, noting the state budget surplus. The state has $2.1 billion surplus, which is projected to grow to $3.1 billion in the next fiscal year, plus another $3.7 billion in the state's taxpayer relief fund. I've been in education for close to 23 years. In that entire time, I've learned one thing. When the state doesn't have enough money, there's not more money for education. When the state does have enough money, there's not enough money for education, he said. Iowa among 20 states to turn down food aid for kids. GOP governors indicate they don't want federal handouts. By Aaron Jordan. Iowa is among 20 states, nearly all led by Republican governors, that won't participate in a federal program that provides hundreds of millions of dollars for summer food aid for children. Leaders of several states that have refused the money say they don't need or want the handout from the Democratic Biden administration, but children's advocates say families are struggling and nonprofits can do only so much. Summer EBT should be a bipartisan, no-brainer policy win for Iowa's kids, Iowa Hunger Coalition Board Chair Luke Elzinga said in a statement last month. Monday was the deadline for states to notify the U.S. Department of Agriculture they wanted to participate in summer EBT, which provides $40 a month to low-income children to use for food during June, July, and August. The USDA reported 30 states, 4 territories, and 2 tribal nations sent word they want to participate in the 2024 program. 20 states did not apply, including the Midwest states of Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, South Dakota, and North Dakota. The USDA website says the list may underrepresent the total number of states, territories, and tribal nations who have declared their intent to participate, but the site also says the list was updated Tuesday, a day after the deadline. Of the states that declined the funding, 18 are led by Republican governors. Pennsylvania, led by Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro, and Rhode Island, led by Democratic Governor Dan McKee, also did not notify USDA of plans to seek the 2024 funding, although both states have participated in the past. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds said December 22nd the state would not join the summer EBT program, opting instead to use state money to enhance other summer food programs she said are more nutritious. Iowa had received more than $20 million per year from summer EBT in past years, lawmakers said. If the Biden administration and Congress want to make a real commitment to family well-being, they should invest in already existing programs and infrastructure at the state level and give us the flexibility to tailor them to our state's needs, Reynolds said in a statement. Iowa Health and Human Services said by not participating in summer EBT, Iowa would save $2.2 million in administrative costs. Critics of the decision said that is the cost of running the entire Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, not just the summer add-on. Of the 132,000 Iowa households enrolled in SNAP, 41.5% have children in the home, the Iowa Human Services Agency reported. SNAP enrollment has declined, down from over 150,000 households in 2020 to 132,000 for 2024, the agency said. Their press release praises the fact that enrollment in SNAP is at a 15-year low in Iowa, Elzinga said, but when we have food banks and food pantries across the state assisting record-breaking numbers of people, that should be worn as a mark of shame, not a badge of honor. A 2018 USDA study of SNAP participants found 61% said the most common hurdle to eating fruits, vegetables, and other healthy food was the cost. Last summer, more than 1.6 million meals and snacks were served to children 18 and younger throughout Iowa as part of the Summer Food Service Program and Seamless Summer Option Program. These are the programs Iowa officials say they will expand in 2024 in lieu of summer EBT. The governor's office did not reply Tuesday to a request to know how much additional funding would go to the state-run summer food programs in 2024. Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen, a Republican, said his state will turn down about $18 million from the USDA for the summer EBT program because I don't believe in welfare, the Lincoln Star Journal reported. We're solving the problem, we're taking care of the kids, and we're doing it in a way that the best value is created and we take care of the kids, Pillen said. Florida also has not filed notice to seek more than $200 million in food aid funding for school kids. Juvenile left car before shootout with CR police. Identity of driver will be released after family notification, further investigation. By Emily Anderson. The passenger who left a car during a police chase that ended in a shootout Monday is a juvenile, according to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Authorities said the car was involved in a drive-by shooting at a house at 414 Longwood Drive Northeast near Tomahawk Park at 6:24 a.m. Monday. Cedar Rapids police responded to reports of the shooting and quickly began pursuing the suspect vehicle, described by the Iowa DCI as being occupied by two males. The driver began shooting with a rifle at police near 1st Avenue and 12th Street Southeast and again near Mount Vernon Road and 34th Street Southeast, investigators said. At some point in the pursuit, the passenger in the suspect vehicle exited the vehicle and was taken into custody by officers, according to a news release from the DCI. Investigators did not say where the passenger got out during the chase or describe the circumstances. As it was being pursued, the car left the roadway around the 5600 block of Mount Vernon Road Southeast, and a high-risk stop was conducted. The driver continued to shoot at officers from inside the car, and five officers returned fire. The driver was found dead in the car. The officers involved were placed on leave while the DCI investigates the shooting, according to the release. The identities of the dead driver and the involved officers will be released after notification of families and further investigation, according to Joe Lestina, DCI special agent in charge of the investigation. The identity of the passenger and any information about any charges he may be facing will not be released to the public because he is a juvenile, Lestina said. An autopsy of the driver's body is being conducted by the Iowa State Medical Examiner's Office in Ankeny, according to Lestina. Johnson County, Iowa City Governments Choose Leaders, by Marissa Payne. The seven-member Iowa City Council on Tuesday elected Bruce Teague mayor to continue to serve as mayor for the third time. Unlike many cities, Iowa City voters do not directly vote for the mayor, so it is the council's decision. His colleagues first elected Teague to the role in 2020. I can't do nothing if I don't do it with the people, Teague said. It is so important that we continue to come together and work together on matters that are common to all of us that we see on a daily basis. An Iowa City resident since 1993, Teague was first elected by voters to the council in 2018. He is the owner and chief executive officer of Caring Hand and More and has earned an associate's from Kirkwood Community College and a bachelor's from the University of Iowa. I see him at so many of our community events, Councilmember Josh Moe said. I'd be proud to have him again. Councilmember Megan Alter, who served as Mayor Pro Tem from 2022 to 2023, nominated Councilmember Mazahir Saleh for Mayor Pro Tem, essentially an assistant mayor who fills in when the mayor isn't available. Alter said she was eager for Saleh to be able to bring the energy and experience to this position. Saleh also was elected and sworn into her seat in November to fill the vacancy created when Janice Weiner resigned after being elected to the Iowa Senate. Saleh previously served on the council from 2018 to 2022, when her election made her the first Sudanese-American official elected to public office in the United States. She served as mayor pro tem alongside Teague in 2020 to 2021. I will promise that I will do my best to do the best for the residents of Iowa City, Saleh said. During her remarks, Saleh said she and Teague broke barriers as the city's first Black leadership duo in Iowa City history. That's sending a really positive message to the community about who Iowa City is, Saleh said. No other nominations were put forward for either position, so the council unanimously supported Teague as mayor and Saleh as mayor pro tem. The five-member Johnson County Board of Supervisors unanimously nominated Supervisor Rod Sullivan to serve as chair. He was first elected to the board in 2004. Sullivan grew up on a heritage farm near Sutliff and attended Lisbon schools. He graduated from the University of Iowa with a bachelor's degree in 1988. In a 4-1 vote, the supervisors nominated Supervisor John Green to serve as vice chair, with Roysanne Porter opposed. Green of Lone Tree was elected to the board in 2021. Originally from Cheyenne, Wyoming, he has spent most of his life in Lone Tree and Nichols. Green attended West Liberty Schools through 6th grade before transferring to Lone Tree, where he graduated in 2001. Green earned a bachelor's degree in mass communication from Morningside University in Sioux City. There was no discussion at the supervisors' Tuesday meeting about the nominations. Porter declined to comment on her vote against Green's appointment as vice chair. GOP candidates hold clashing events. Trump will hold event conflicting with debate between DeSantis and Haley, by Caleb McCullough of the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau. Former President Donald Trump will skip a televised debate 5 days before Iowa's caucuses, featuring Republican rivals Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley, and will instead hold a competing event at the same time. And presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, who failed to qualify for the CNN debate stage, also will hold his own event at the same time. The end result, 3 clashing Republican campaign events in Des Moines. They're all scheduled to start at 8 p.m. January 10th. Iowa's Republican caucuses will be held January 15th. Florida Governor DeSantis and former South Carolina Governor Haley will participate in the CNN debate, which the network announced last month, at Drake University. To participate in the debate, a candidate had to receive at least 10% support in 3 national and or Iowa polls, limiting participation to DeSantis, Haley, and Trump. But Trump, who leads the field in polling, will skip it and instead participate in a live Fox News town hall from Des Moines, which will air at the same time. The town hall will be moderated by Fox News anchors Brett Beyer and Martha McCallum, the network announced Tuesday. Haley and DeSantis criticized Trump's refusal to participate in the debate, which likely will be the last time candidates face off head-to-head before the caucuses. With only 3 candidates qualifying, it's time for Donald Trump to show up, Haley said in a statement Tuesday. As the debate stage continues to shrink, it's getting harder for Donald Trump to hide. DeSantis campaign spokesperson Andrew Romeo blasted Trump for skipping the debate and said he must defend his policies while president. We understand Donald Trump is scared to get on the stage because he'd have to finally explain why he didn't build the wall, added nearly $8 trillion to the debt, and turned the country over to Fauci, Romeo said, referring to Anthony Fauci, the former chief medical advisor during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. But even Democratic California Governor Gavin Newsom had the courage to stand on the stage to debate his own failed record against Ron DeSantis. If it would make the debate more inviting, we would gladly agree to make it a seated format where the former president would be more comfortable. Trump has skipped the last 4 Republican primary debates, arguing his dominance in polling means he does not need to debate his opponents. In a statement last month, Trump campaign spokesperson Stephen Chung said Trump is dominating every single poll by historic margins when asked if he would participate in the CNN debate. These other candidates are currently sitting at the kids' table, wishing they could graduate to the adult table, Chung said. In a statement Tuesday, the Ohio Biotech Entrepreneurs Campaign for Vivek Ramaswamy called CNN a ratings wasteland and accused the network of being biased against Ramaswamy. The campaign announced the candidate would participate in a live audience town hall hosted by Tim Pool, a podcast host whose channel, Timcast IRL, has 1.6 million subscribers on YouTube. Pool's podcast will be hosted live in studio in Des Moines from January 10th to January 15th, Ramaswamy's campaign said. Forget CNN's fake Iowa debate on January 10th, which will be the most boring in modern history, Ramaswamy said on social media. We're doing a live audience show that night in Des Moines with Tim Pool instead. Won't hold back. Hoover Museum's campaign gets $1 million boost. Gift from Joanne and the late Ernie Burrish for London Life exhibit by Diana Nolan. In a season of giving, a $1 million gift from Joanne and the late Ernest Ernie Burrish of Cedar Rapids is bringing a bit of London to the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. It's also bringing the Hoover Presidential Foundation closer to its $20 million fundraising goal for a state-of-the-art museum makeover. The Timeless Values Modern Experience campaign, unveiled in 2021, now stands at about 73% complete. Another major milestone came earlier this year with a $1 million gift from Myron Mike Wilson of Cedar Rapids and his late wife, Esther Wilson. The campaign's culmination is to be celebrated August 10th, the 150th anniversary of Hoover's birth in West Branch. The museum then will close so the public spaces can be renovated. The work is expected to be finished by mid-2026, said Mundy McCarty, president and CEO of the Hoover Presidential Foundation. Joanne Burrish has designated her gift for the London Life exhibit, showcasing a personal slice of Herbert and Lou Henry Hoover's life, which parallels the Burrish family's love for traveling and sharing experiences with their children, including visits to the museum complex when daughters Wendy and Sandra were young. Ernest Burrish, a respected influential banker and philanthropist in eastern Iowa, died April 24, 2022, at age 95. His obituary noted, Ernie believed strongly in giving back both of his time and his financial resources, making significant contributions to various programs at the University of Iowa, area hospitals, libraries, and museums, including this posthumous gift. The Hoover gift honors the life and legacy of the 31st President of the United States in office from 1929 to 1933. Hoover was known as the Great Humanitarian for his hunger relief efforts at home and abroad during and after both World Wars. Ernie admired President Hoover for all that he did for our country and the world, recognizing that he and his wife deserved more recognition for their intellectual and humanitarian contributions that have often gone unnoticed, Joanne Burrish said in a statement announcing the gift. McCarty said Hoover trustees and family members got to know Ernie Burrish and discussed with him his passion for the state of Iowa, for our region, for history as well. She also counts herself fortunate for getting to know Joanne and Wendy Burrish and see how important Iowa history is to them at the state level and beyond. The Hoover story is a global one, so they very much recognize the impact that their support could have on this project, McCarty said. The Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum opened on August 10, 1962, Hoover's 88th birthday. His friend, former President Harry S. Truman, joined him in dedicating the facility. Hoover died 2 years later in New York City. He and his wife, a native of Waterloo, are buried on a hill overlooking his humble birthplace cottage in West Branch. A major museum building renovation in 1992 increased the museum's footprint from 32,000 to 44,500 square feet. 30 years later, this latest renovation will incorporate 21st century advances to engage audiences of all ages in the exhibits. Right now is the perfect time to reinvent the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library Museum, granddaughter Margaret Hoover, a political commentator and host of Firing Line on PBS, says in a video explaining the project's goals. We've had an entire technological revolution, an information revolution. Matthew Solari, creative director at BRC Imagination Arts in Burbank, California, the partner in the project's concept design, said the project presented an opportunity to create a museum that is vital, that is immersive, that is emotional, that brings all kinds of theatrical storytelling and wizardry, and that tells a classic American story. We want to activate their sense of civic partnership, their civic responsibility to be a part of making the world a better place, he adds. That way, Hoover becomes more relevant today than he has been any time in the last 50 years. The BRC firm specializes in creating premier exhibit spaces and turned the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum into what's said to be the first major experience museum. Education is less like filling a bucket and more like lighting a fire, BRC founder Bob Rogers notes. We're going to tell that story in a way that captures the imagination, inspires people, and leaves them hungry for more. adds Margaret Hoover, you want to build a world-class presidential library museum, tell a story in a new way and in a creative way that will resonate with a new generation, a new audience of people. Silent book clubs are introvert happy hour. Freedom to choose whatever you want to read, appealing to corridor readers, by Marissa Payne. Rows of wrapped books keeping the novel inside a mystery were lined up in the Iowa City Public Library on a recent weeknight as community members gathered for bookish camaraderie culminating in a holiday book swap. Blind date with a thriller, one book beckoned. Fantasy adventure, called another, each with a brief description teasing the contents inside. Tote bags were strewn across a table. About a dozen people circled around it while they chatted about books and decorated the bags that can be used to hold all their books from the library or store. More than an hour later, one green tote was designated as My Stash, STACHE, of books, complete with a mustache doodle. The gathering marked only the fifth meeting of Iowa City's Silent Book Club and its first non-silent event. Cedar Rapids and Iowa City each in recent months have started local chapters of a group that is seeing growing popularity worldwide as book lovers embrace the idea of a low-commitment book club where they can find community with other voracious readers. Book clubs typically provide a space for people to read the same book in their own time, then gather and discuss it. At a silent book club meeting, there's a dedicated time to socialize and grab a beverage, if desired, at the business where patrons are connecting. Then everyone has time to read in silence. Attendees can bring any book of their choice, and it doesn't have to be finished. Emerson Craig, a student in the University of Iowa's Spanish Literature PhD program, said the process for setting up a group took minimal effort. With the advice of the coordinators and founders of Silent Book Club at silentbook.club, Craig enlisted people to come, created social media accounts to announce meetings, and made plans for the first meeting. Originally from Massachusetts, Craig said it wasn't until starting the local silent book club that he truly felt like he was part of the Iowa City community. Being in one of just two American cities designated as a UNESCO City of Literature, Craig said he's found people eager to embrace the club. With students in the club's attendee mix, Craig said what appeals to the Hawkeyes, who are loaded with homework, is that freedom to choose what you want to read. It's essentially introvert happy hour. It is not having to feel like you have to slug through a book to go to the meeting. Then if you don't read the book you're supposed to, you're like, should I even go this time? Craig said. Engaging in book talk with other book lovers is like winning a personal pan pizza from Pizza Hut through its nearly 40-year-old Book It program that encourages children to read, Craig said. It's like that joy of reading when you were a kid all over again, Craig said. In the corner of the room, Marguerite Miller, 70, of Iowa City, read The Children's Book by A.S. Byatt. Having tried to start a similar group before COVID-19's global spread upended life in 2020, she's been a regular attendee and a helping hand to Craig. The group's winter reading bingo challenge has been a motivator for her to read consistently this season. I'm guessing we were all big readers when we were 8, 10, 12 years old, Miller said, before life's distractions got in the way. It's nice to feel the community. Brittany Anderson, 30, a graduate student in the UI's Anthropology PhD program, said she came into the group not knowing anyone but seeking bookish spaces. Anderson appreciates having dedicated reading time, a rarity as a graduate student. I like that you have the freedom to choose whatever you want to read that week or that month, Anderson said, and you get to socialize with other people who read. Reading is an insular hobby in a lot of ways, and this is a way to gather with other people who enjoy doing the same thing you do, even if you don't enjoy the same books. At Cedar Rapids' second meeting last month at Iowa Brewing Company, books ranged from The Christmas Fix by Lucy Score, a fictional romance novel, to Atomic Habits by James Clear, a nonfiction hit for those resolving to build healthy habits that stick in the new year. Sierra Charnowski, one of the Cedar Rapids club organizers, said this type of group appealed to her because she doesn't like assigned reading. Charnowski said she typically gravitates toward romance or memoirs and has received recommendations about new authors or books that weren't yet on her to-be-read list. I have friends, but none of them are interested in books, Charnowski said. I don't really have anybody to talk books with other than a couple of co-workers, but we don't hang out outside of work. I was like, okay, I want to be able to meet other people that are interested in books as well and get other options for books in different genres. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, January 3rd, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Master Sergeant Robert Bob Lee Rimrode passed away at 4:10 a.m. December 30th in Cedar Rapids after a short illness. He graduated from Jefferson High School in 1961 before spending over 20 years in the U.S. Army. A wake is planned for January, time and place to be determined. Reverend Bob Welsh of Iowa City passed away peacefully at home December 1st, surrounded by his family. In lieu of flowers, memorial gifts may be made in Bob's honor to Community Crisis Services of Iowa City, where Bob's granddaughter Sarah currently serves as CEO. A service in celebration of life will be held Saturday, January 6th at 1 p.m. at the First Christian Church in Coralville. For a complete obituary to share a thought, memory, or condolence, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service website at gayandchia.com. Michael G. McConaughey, 64 years old and formerly from the Mount Vernon area, passed away surrounded by loved ones on December 23rd at home in Boise, Idaho. Private services will be held in Boise. Mike worked as a technician in the micrographics industry. He served his country for 4 years in the U.S. Navy. Mike is the son of Glenn McConaughey and Sandra Horman McConaughey, deceased. Larry Sherrill, 80, passed away on January 1st. Memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. on Thursday, January 4th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion, with visitation 1 hour prior to service. Interment will be in Springville Cemetery at a later date. Larry was a car guy. He loved to buy, drive, and sell vehicles. He worked for Quaker Oats for over 25 years. Memorials may be directed to the family. Please share a memory of Larry at murdochfuneralhome.com. Ethel Margaret Ackerman Winger, age 72, of Cedar Rapids, died on January 1st. A celebration of life party will be held on Friday, January 5th from 3 to 7 p.m. at the VFW on Southgate Place Southwest in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held later this summer at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church in Hiawatha. A private celebration will occur in July at her and Denny's cabin on Lake Delhi, her happy place, when her cremated remains will go for her final boat ride. She was born on January 29, 1951, to Harry G. and Clara Vansness Ackerman in Cedar Rapids and graduated from Kennedy High School in 1969. She met the love of her life, Denny Winger, in 1971. They were married in September of 1973. A 50th anniversary family vacation was taken in July 2023 to Eastern Tennessee with all 18 family members, and many great memories were made. Ethel worked various office-related jobs in her life, but her favorite job was that of wife and mother. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Habitat for Humanity. Georgine M. Grimm, 82, of Hiawatha, passed away on Sunday, December 31st at Unity Point St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Visitation, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m., Tuesday, January 9th, Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services, Cedar Rapids. Funeral, 1:30 p.m., Tuesday, January 9th, at the funeral home. Burial, Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Georgine Grimm was born on August 30th, 1941, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the daughter of George J. and Angeline M. Chicanti Staub. She married Merle Grimm in Las Vegas, Nevada. George enjoyed traveling and music. A general memorial fund has been established for the family in care of Merle Grimm. Please share your support and memories with Georgine's family on her tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. After an extended illness, Anna Williams fell asleep in death on Saturday, December 30th. Anna Vieira Williams was born on September 12, 1980, in Cedar Rapids. She is the daughter of Wesley Williams and Elizabeth Jones. Anna was a longtime resident of Cedar Rapids. She attended Jefferson High School. Anna was a kind and gentle lady. Despite all that she endured, Anna felt true compassion for others. Anna had a genuine love for the true God Jehovah her whole life. She was comforted by the sure hope of the resurrection. A memorial service will be at 1 p.m. Saturday, January 6th, at the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses in Cedar Rapids. Anne Elizabeth Slattery Smothers of Iowa City was born December 20th, 1946, to Thomas William and Bessie Louise Hudson Slattery in Chicago, Illinois. Massive Christian burial will be celebrated at 11 a.m. Saturday, January 6th at St. Mary Catholic Church. Visitation will be Friday from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. Burial will be at St. Joseph's Cemetery. The service will be live-streamed on the St. Mary Church Iowa City website. Contributions in Anne's name may be directed to the U of I Foundation Old Capital Endowment Fund or St. Mary's Catholic Church. Anne was a 1965 graduate of Regina High School and Iowa City Commercial College, attended the University of Iowa and Iowa Central Community College. She was employed by Northwestern Bell, the State of Iowa, Mercy Hospital, Pittsburgh Paint and Glass, and the University of Iowa at Old Capitol Museum, ending her career as director. On December 3, 1965, Ann was united in marriage to Terry Allen Smothers at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City. Online condolences may be left at lensingfuneral.com. Ann Catherine Sullivan Powers of Cedar Rapids passed away peacefully at home on December 28th, surrounded by her family. She was 91. Services, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church, where the family will receive friends at the visitation from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Friday, January 5th in Hiawatha. The funeral mass will be celebrated at 11 a.m. The burial will be at St. Clement's Cemetery in Dunlap, Illinois, at a later date. She was born on February 25, 1932, to John Charles Sullivan and Dorothy Kamensky Sullivan in Davenport, Iowa. Ann attended Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois, and graduated from Bradley University in Peoria, Illinois. She taught music for more than 30 years in Dunlap, Illinois, Aurora, Illinois, Sterling, Illinois, Holy Cross, Iowa, and Guttenberg, Iowa. Ann served on the school board at Sauk Valley Community College in Dixon, Illinois. She also owned and managed rental properties in Illinois. Music was a lifelong passion. Ann was the choir director for St. Mary Catholic Church in Guttenberg. As a founding member of the Guttenberg German Band and ANZ's band, she traveled throughout the Midwest and Europe, sharing her love of music with others. She was a talented pianist and played trumpet in the New Horizons Band in Cedar Rapids until the age of 91. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be sent to the New Horizons Band of Cedar Rapids or Camp Courageous. Online condolences can be left at tnfuneralhome.com. Gail Victoria Raymond, 66, of Phoenix, Arizona, passed away on December 23rd at the Joy and Care Living Facility in Phoenix. Private family services have been held with burial at St. George Orthodox Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Brosh Chapel in the Abba Center in Cedar Rapids is serving the family. Gail was born on June 1, 1957 in San Francisco, California. She is the daughter of James William Raymond and Margaret Ann Hattie Raymond. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at broshchapel.com. John Hart, 85, of Anamosa, died Sunday, December 31st at the Hiawatha Care Center following an extended illness. Visitation will be held Saturday afternoon, January 6th, from 1 until 3 p.m. at the Getch Funeral Home, Anamosa. Graveside services will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established. Thoughts, memories, and condolences may be left at getchonline.com. John Charles Hart was born October 3, 1938, in Cedar Rapids. He was the son of Charles and Elizabeth Newland Hart. John was the valedictorian of his class of 1956 at Viola High School. He then started his life's occupation working on the railroad. He started with the Milwaukee Railroad and finished his career at the Crandick Railroad. John married Joyce Marie Harms in 1958. They later divorced. John married Karen Diane Hilbert in 2004. They had been a couple since 1989. The couple took many wonderful trips together, going to Europe, Mexico, and Hawaii. In 2009, they started wintering in McAllen, Texas, until her death in 2017. His hobbies and passions were playing golf and walking his dogs, Charlie and Charlie Pup. Jeremy Sherwood Loops, born on May 22, 1973, in Iowa City, departed from this world on December 18th. Jeremy's life was a testament to a deep love for family. Jeremy grew up in Iowa City, Iowa, before moving to Arizona and creating a life for himself and his family there. He graduated from Arizona State University, where he received a Bachelor of Science in Business with a focus on purchasing logistics. Jeremy's presence will be deeply missed, but his spirit lives on in the hearts of those who knew and loved him. His warm smile, unwavering support, and genuine kindness left an indelible mark on everyone fortunate enough to cross his path. The family invites friends and loved ones to join in a celebration of Jeremy's life to be announced at a future date. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that donations be made to the University of Iowa Center for Advancement for the UI Stead Family Children's Hospital Fund. Ivadel L. Ivy Peterson, 100, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, December 31st. A graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. on Saturday, January 6th at Campbell Cemetery in Bertram Township on Mount Vernon Road in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids assisted the family. Ivadel was born March 4, 1923 in Fulda, Minnesota, the daughter of George and Emma Otterbein. At the age of 9, she and her parents moved to Northwest Iowa, where she received her education. She attended Northwest Institute of Medical Technology in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and was employed at Ellsworth Hospital until her marriage to Clayton Peterson on August 16, 1953. She was active in her church and taught Sunday school and Bible school. She was devoted to her family and enjoyed being around people. Please share a memory of Ivadel at murdochfuneralhome.com. Jose Luis Burgos Huesos, 57, of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, December 30th at his home. A visitation will be held from 4 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, January 4th at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids. Funeral Mass will take place at 10 a.m. on Friday, January 5th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Burial will follow in Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. For the full obituary and to share a memory of Jose, please visit murdochfuneralhome.com. Donna Hodge, 88, of Cedar Rapids, passed away Saturday, December 30th at her home, surrounded by family. Services will be held Friday, January 5th at 11 a.m. with a visitation beginning at 10 a.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. A live stream of the funeral service may be accessed on the funeral home website. Burial in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Donna Jean Frank was born July 19, 1935, in Wapakoneta, Ohio, to Harry and Geraldine Frank. She attended Bloom High School and graduated in 1953. Following graduation, she was hired as secretary to the principal and the superintendent of the town schools. She met the love of her life, Dick Hodge, at the end of her senior year on a blind date. They were married on February 12, 1955. They lived in Columbus and Waterville, Ohio for 5 years before moving to Cedar Rapids when Dick was hired by Collins Radio. Donna was an active member in Eastern Star and became worthy Grand Matron in 1986. In 1988, she was elected to the office of Grand Secretary and held that office until April 1999 when she retired. At the Grand Chapter Session that year, she was voted the distinction of Grand Secretary Emeritus. She was a 50-plus year member. Memorial donations may be directed to Marian Methodist Church. Online condolences may be left for the family at cedarmemorial.com. Charlotte R. Kephart, 76, of Anamosa, passed away December 30th at Mercy Medical Center ICU in Cedar Rapids from complications of Hodgkin's lymphoma. Visitation will be held Thursday, January 4th from 12 to 2 at Cedar Memorial in Cedar Rapids. Private graveside service will follow. Charlotte was born March 28, 1947, in Cedar Rapids. She was a graduate of Washington High School. Charlotte worked in various retail and service careers while raising her wonderful children. She was employed by Priority Express until her retirement. Charlotte enjoyed crocheting, knitting, embroidering, collecting cookbooks, and reading Amish novels. Her special talent was creating unique greeting cards from scratch. She especially enjoyed her Shih Tzus, her home, fishing, and spending the summer at a cabin on the Mississippi River. Memorials may be directed to the American Cancer Society in her name. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com. Marie Gail Spies Ellingson, 88, of Marion, was born on March 26, 1935, in Union, Iowa, the daughter of Clarence Raymond and Goldie Iola Clark Spies. She passed away with loving family nearby on New Year's Day, Monday, January 1st, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. The family will greet friends from 9 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, January 6th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, with a memorial service to begin at 11 a.m. Burial will follow at Mount Clark Cemetery in Central City. Please share a memory of Marie at murdochfuneralhome.com. James Allen Heavens, 72, of Dyersville, died unexpectedly on his way home from work on the evening of December 28th. Visitation will be held from 2 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, January 7th at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. prior to the funeral mass. Funeral Mass will begin at 10:30 a.m. on Monday, January 8th at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville. Reverend Chris Pohaski will officiate. Jim was born on June 16, 1951 in Springfield, Illinois, the son of Alan and Esther Durker Heavens. Jim graduated from Coal City High School and then from the University of Illinois with a Bachelor of Science in Agriculture in 1973. He then went on to graduate school at the University of Illinois, where he received a Master of Science in 1975 and a Doctor of Philosophy in 1978. After college, Jim started out working for Hubbard Feeds in Mankato, Minnesota. While there, Jim met Hubbard's attorney, Dick Beerling, who thought it would be a good idea if Jim asked Dick's sister Kathy on a date. It turned out to be a great idea. Jim and Kathy were married on April 9, 1983. They created and lived a truly wonderful life together for over 40 years. The Heavens family moved from Mankato to Charles City and then to Dyersville when Jim began working for U.S. Feeds. The family loved Dyersville, and Dyersville loved them back. Jim was very active in the community and was elected mayor of Dyersville in 2003. He was re-elected 6 times and served until 2021. Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville is assisting the family. Information is available at kramerfuneral.com. Memorials may be sent to Kramer Funeral Home. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving on to the editorial page, there are three letters to the editor today. Here's the first one. It is from John Clayton of Brooklyn. The headline is Donald Trump's removal from ballot is legitimate. Keeping Donald Trump off the ballot due to being an insurrectionist is a legitimate action for a democracy to exert. Keeping an insurrectionist off the ballot is so the insurrectionist voters don't gain control. That would spell an end to our democracy. That's a letter from John Clayton of Brooklyn. Next is a letter from Mark Levin of Olwine. It's titled Denying Extra Food, Help Not Christian. Well, she did it again. Now the governor has turned down federal money to help children in low-income families with food costs during the summer. With school not in session, food is limited for the children. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds' reasoning is, it does nothing to promote nutrition at a time when childhood obesity has become an epidemic. So I guess we let our children go hungry. Many government officials claim to be Christians. However, their actions do not follow the guidelines of Christianity, help the poor. Can we put Christ back in Christian? That's a letter from Mark Levin of Olwine. Next is a letter from Judy Fole of Iowa City. The title is, Who Will Fill Iowa Children's Need for Food? Last month, our governor, that's in quotation marks, refused $20 million in federal dollars for summer meals for hungry Iowa kids. Now she can claim saving $2 million in administrative costs for a budget. Food stamps, now EBT, have helped Iowans since the 1970s. Should we refuse federal crop insurance this year, too? Will the need for food be filled by the top percent getting the new tax breaks? How much will the governor donate? That's a letter by Judy Fole of Iowa City. Here's a guest column by Brett Nils. Democrats should attend the caucuses. As we approach the upcoming Iowa caucuses, I am writing to emphasize the crucial role your participation will play in shaping the future of our great state. The Iowa caucuses are more than just a political event. They are a unique opportunity for Iowa Democrats like yourself to actively engage in the democratic process and influence the direction of our party, even without the presidential preference portion as part of the in-person caucuses this year. Even though it will not be the same for Iowa Democrats, attending the Iowa caucuses allows you to have a direct impact on the selection of our party's direction by electing precinct representation and delegates to the county convention. By participating in the caucuses, you contribute to the democratic decision-making process, ensuring that our party's candidate truly reflects the values and priorities of Iowa Democrats with the submission of the Democratic Party platform. Your voice is a powerful tool that can influence the outcome of the caucus, shaping the landscape of our political representation. Moreover, the Iowa caucuses serve as platforms for open dialogue and discussion among fellow Democrats. This event provides an opportunity for you to voice your concerns, share your perspectives, and engage in meaningful conversations with like-minded individuals who are equally passionate about the future of our state and country. These interactions foster a sense of community and solidarity, strengthening the bonds that tie us together as Iowa Democrats committed to positive change to make Iowa and the country a better place for all of us. Additionally, the Iowa caucuses are a crucial moment for highlighting the diversity within our party. It is a chance for Democrats from across the state to come together and celebrate the richness of our collective experiences. By attending the caucuses, you contribute to the representation of a broad spectrum of voices, ensuring that our party is inclusive and reflective of the vibrant tapestry that makes up Iowa. Furthermore, the eyes of the nation are on Iowa during the caucuses, as the results often set the tone for the rest of the primary season. Your participation not only influences our state, but also sends a powerful message to the rest of the country about the values and priorities that matter to Democrats. Your presence at the caucuses contributes to the broader narrative of our party on a national scale. I urge you to consider the profound impact your attendance at the Iowa caucuses can have on the future of our party and our state. Your voice matters, and your participation is vital in shaping the Democratic agenda for the years to come. Let us come together, engage in thoughtful discourse, and collectively chart a course toward a better and more inclusive Iowa. We also encourage you to request your presidential preference card at iowademocrats.org by February 19th. Thank you for your dedication to the democratic process, and I look forward to seeing you at the Iowa caucuses. Brett Nils is chair of the Linn County Democrats and a member of the Iowa Democratic Party State Central Committee. We have a few minutes for sports before our time is up. Here is today's article about Iowa football. It's called A Sour Reality Check. Iowa's 35-0 loss dampens optimism after a 10-win season West title, by John Stepp. Several years from now, Jay Higgins will not be telling his future children about what play we called or what the offense or defense did or didn't do. We got two divisional rings, the Iowa linebacker said after Monday's Citrus Bowl loss, referencing the Hawkeyes' 2021 and 2023 Big Ten West football titles. We'll tell the kids about that. In the shorter term, though, the Hawkeyes' 35-0 loss to Tennessee left a salty taste in many fans' mouths, perhaps even saltier than the Cheez-It snack that sponsored the game, and delivered a sour reality check after much talk about the 10-win season and Big Ten West title. It was Iowa's third game against a ranked opponent, and it was Iowa's third shutout loss. Ranked opponents outscored the Hawkeyes this season 92-0. That is the worst scoring margin in the Big Ten West, despite the division having a 1-16 record against ranked teams. The one win was Minnesota's controversial victory over Iowa when the Hawkeyes were number 24 in the Associated Press poll. Iowa's losses to Penn State and Michigan were against teams that were undefeated at the time and finished the season in the top 10 of final college football playoff rankings. The loss to Tennessee, on the contrary, was to a four-loss team ravaged by injuries, opt-outs, and transfer portal departures. Iowa still won 10 games, a feat that has happened in only 7 of Kirk Ferentz's 25 seasons at the helm, and did so with stellar defense and special teams play that often made up for subpar offensive production. In Iowa's 10 wins, the Hawkeyes allowed only 11.2 points per game while often working with a thin margin for error. Three of Iowa's last four wins were decided by 3 or fewer points. We asked a lot from this defense this year, and I'm extremely proud, Higgins said. The defense thrived despite losing several starters from last year's team, including 4 who were on NFL rosters. You lose a Jack Campbell, Higgins said. You lose a Lucas Van Ness. You lose a Riley Moss. You lose a Kayvon Merriweather. I don't know there were too many people that really thought we were going to be a 10-win team. Iowa's defense allowed 4.08 yards per play this season, marking the second consecutive season in which the Hawkeyes led the country in the statistic. Iowa's offense, on the other hand, ranked 130th nationally out of 130 non-reclassifying FBS teams, with 3.94 yards gained per play. It is the fewest yards gained per play in a season by a Power 5 team in the last 3 seasons. The last Power 5 team to average fewer than 4 yards per play was the 2020 Kansas Jayhawks, who went 0-9. The margin for error for the Hawkeyes is about to get thinner as the Big Ten does away with divisions and adds 4 historically strong football programs. 5 of the top 10 teams in this year's final CFP rankings will compete in the Big Ten next year and be potential obstacles for a return to Indianapolis. 2 of those teams, Washington and Ohio State, are on Iowa's 2024 schedule. Another of Iowa's 2024 foes, UCLA, was in the top 10 of the AP poll twice during the 2022 season. We have played some top teams, and we've been a top 10 team, Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said after Monday's loss. So I think we know what it takes and what is required. We've played at that level. We have played teams at that level. We have beaten teams at that level. Iowa almost certainly will need better offensive production to be victorious in those games than when it averaged 2.3 yards per play against Penn State or 2.8 yards per play against Michigan and Tennessee. We just got to get better, and we will, Ferentz said. That is the plan. We will start that work in about 2 weeks. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, January 3rd, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
Some would call 88-year-old Sally Jackson a lucky senior.
A few years ago, a family member offered to move in and care for Sally so that she wouldn't have to leave the comfort of her own home.
But soon after, one of Sally's neighbors, Carol, paid a visit, unannounced.
Something wasn't quite right.
Sally's demeanor and physical appearance had changed.
Luckily, Carol was aware of warning signs that might signal elder abuse.
Such as bruises, poor hygiene,
isolation, depression,
appearing withdrawn or unusually quiet, as if to hide something.
When victimized, elderly people often feel ashamed, confused.
But an alert neighbor helped Sally.
Not all abused seniors are as lucky as Sally Jackson.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. The National Crime Prevention Council wants to help you and your loved ones prevent elder abuse. Know what to look for. Know how to report it to local law enforcement agencies.
To learn more, go to ncpc.org/seniors. That's ncpc.org/seniors. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Department of Justice.